From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Occupational licensing rules restrict economic freedom. A recent presentation in Winston-Salem focused on the impact for both North Carolina and South Carolina. You'll hear highlights. North Carolina's junior U.S. Senator, Tom Tillis, wants to speed up federal hurricane disaster relief. You'll learn how he's pursuing that goal in Congress. Are North Carolina legislators hooked on phonics? You'll hear debate about a recent proposal involving early public school reading instruction. And we'll explain how the Small Business Health Care Act could benefit thousands of North Carolina workers and small business owners. It involves something called association health plans. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
Over the years, many North Carolina laws and rules have added to the list of activities deemed to be crimes in North Carolina. Things have gotten so convoluted that the John Locke Foundation is now working to help provide lawmakers with knowledge and the best way to modernize what's known as the criminal code to make it more clear, more efficient, and more fair. This reform effort recently took a pretty big step forward. And the John Locke Foundation's legal fellow, Mike Sheetzelt, is here to help us understand what is happening. Mike, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
First of all, when we say criminal code, what are we talking about here?
Right. We're talking about everything that's a crime in North Carolina. So the general statutes, the common law, the code of ordinances for each town and city and county, and any administrative rules.
So not just, say, murder, robbery, anything like that.
Anything from murder or robbery to your local ordinances against maybe panhandling or letting your lawn grow too tall is one we've talked about a lot.
It appears that what's happened is that over the many decades, everybody has just kind of piled on, whether it's your local city council or the state legislature. And for one reason or another, they've decided that certain things are a crime, and it's all kind of buried in mountains of paperwork. And you are here saying, hey, wait a second, we need to figure out where everything is, where it exists, and what makes sense and what doesn't.
Right. They started with the common law. When we were a colony, it was the common law. The legislature kind of took on the onus of adding to the common law for a while. And then in the late 19th century, they delegated it out to local governments as well. And of course, as the administrative state has risen up, they've delegated that authority also to administrative agencies. So it's just kind of a problem of how much we've delegated, how little oversight there is over all of this, and it's just grown unchecked. A colleague just used the word metastasized this morning about it, and I think that's a good way to describe it.
And in a lot of cases, as you have written about this at johnlock.org, people can run afoul of the law, have no idea that they have technically committed a crime in North Carolina until someone calls them on it, and they end up trying to fight some sort of legal battle, and they just don't even know it. So that, because of all of that, you have really taken on this effort to try to help lawmakers understand where everything is. And they've taken some very interesting and positive steps forward. First of all, tell us about what is already in place, which is called, and this is a mouthful, the Criminal Law Recodification Working Group. What does that really mean, Mike?
Right. So the Recodification Working Group was never actually a formalized group that was put into the bill. It was in the title of the bill. But there was a group of people from the Administrative Office of the Courts, from law enforcement, legislators who were interested in tackling this problem, also from the academic community and the policy community. So we've gotten a group together that had been working on these issues, kind of discussing where this needed to go. And the first thing was, well, you know, we need to get this information in. We don't know exactly where to start until we have all the information in front of us about what is criminal. So that bill, the Recodification Working Group bill, asked cities, counties, municipal sewerage districts, and administrative agencies for this information. What is criminal in your jurisdiction? What crimes have you defined?
Now, this legislative session, there has been a step forward here that you've written about, and three different things in particular are going to occur that you say and you write about are really going to benefit North Carolinians. Let's talk about those. First of all, you write about an incentive for local governments to actually submit reports on all this.
Right. So the response rate to the first request, the working group bill, was low. And probably part of the reason for that is, well, A, it's cumbersome, but B, there was nothing – I mean, there was no carrot and no stick, right? They didn't have any incentive to respond to this. What this bill does is it kind of creates the incentive. If local governments of above a certain population threshold don't respond, then their ability to create new crimes or define new crimes within their jurisdiction – is frozen for a period of 2 years while the General Assembly gets the information it needs from their code of ordinances. So that's an important step forward now. Hopefully we'll have a higher response rate, and with a higher response rate, more accurate information to move forward with.
You also write about something called automatic legislative review. Help us understand what that is and how that's going to help.
Right. So that's more oriented toward the agencies. So administrative agencies, they pass rules. These rules define criminal conduct. Usually the legislature will have delegated that authority to them, saying any rule promulgated under this article, the violation of any rule promulgated under this article will carry a class 2 misdemeanor, something like that. So now whenever an agency passes a rule like that, the rule will automatically have to be reviewed by the General Assembly through their rules review process. So the General Assembly can essentially veto it and say, listen, you know, we'll allow civil penalties for this crime, but we're not going to allow it or we're not going to allow the agency, we're not going to allow law enforcement to impose a criminal penalty for this violation.
Mike, was there pushback from local governments as this was all being debated?
There was. There was quite a bit of pushback. The earlier versions of this bill were a bit more ambitious and wanted to put an end to the practice of automatically criminalizing local ordinances or most local ordinances. And then also to put a sunset on the local ordinances that were already criminal. There was, understandably, I think, a lot of pushback. The bill hit a lot of headwinds in that process.
Nobody wants to give up power. That's
right.
Just human
nobody
nature.
Wants to give up power.
And as soon as somebody else comes along and says, hey, you're not going to be able to do this, you've got to stop that, naturally, the hackles come up.
Right. And, of course, law enforcement relies on this as an enforcement mechanism. If somebody doesn't have property, or for example, civil penalties aren't going to be quite as effective in enforcing the law because there's no property to attach the civil penalty to. We can't say pay us the $250 or we will seize your car or something like that. So it gets kind of hard when you're enforcing a noise ordinance against a college student who doesn't have any property in the area.
Right.
There was a lot of understandable pushback from the groups representing local governments. And we've gotten a lot of positive feedback on that I think will help us move forward in this process more effectively.
You know, Mike, as I've been reading your writings on this, and all of this, of course, is available at johnlock.org, it's been amazing to me to learn about the fact that things are so different from city to county, across the state, from regions, you know, because you have local governing boards who are going about their business and they are enacting these things. And then, you know, counties that are three or four counties away may be doing something completely different. That leads me to the next item that you write about that you say is so important in this new legislation, and that is consistency statewide.
Right. You know, uniformity is a goal that we should strive for with the criminal law in particular, because again, you're talking about the state's ability to seize your life, liberty, or property. And so there needs to be, to the extent possible, uniformity in the rules across the state. Now, practically, it's kind of hard to make that a reality, but to the extent possible, it's what we should strive for.
Mike Sheetseltz is the legal fellow for the John Locke Foundation. He's working on this whole effort to help reform North Carolina's criminal code, and you can read about the latest step forward at johnlocke.org. Mike, thank you for joining us.
And thank you for having me.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment. Tired of fake news? Tired of reporters with political axes to grind? Well, you need to be reading Carolina Journal. Honest, uncompromising, old-school journalism you expect and you need. Even better, the monthly Carolina Journal is free to subscribers. Sign up at carolinajournal.com. You'll receive Carolina Journal newspaper in your mailbox each month. Investigations into government spending, revelations about boondoggles, who the powerful leaders are and what they're doing in your name and with your money. We shine the light on it all with the stories and angles other outlets barely cover. But there's a bonus. Our print newspaper is published monthly, but our daily news site gives you the latest news each and every day. Log on to carolinajournal.com once, twice, even three times a day. You won't be disappointed. It's fresh news. And if you'd like a heads up on the daily news, sign up for our daily email. Do that at carolinajournal.com. Carolina Journal, rigorous, unrelenting, old school journalism. We hold government accountable for you.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Most of us expect certain jobs, like being a medical doctor, to require a license. But licensing for some jobs seems to create more problems than it solves. During the recent annual meeting of the group Classical Liberals in the Carolinas, an expert panel focused on the impact of occupational licensing in both North and South Carolina. John Sanders is Director of Regulatory Studies at the John Locke Foundation. He says North Carolina has a long history of placing access to jobs under government control.
I was struck a few years ago reading Milton Friedman's Capitalism and Freedom, and in his section on occupational licensing, he quoted this economist, Walter Gellhorn, who noted that as long ago as 1938, a single state, North Carolina, had extended its law, talking about licensing, to 60 occupations. So it's been a long problem, long time problem in North Carolina, 60 occupations in 1938. So how many boards and agencies are we talking about in North Carolina now? In 2014, two separate state groups tried to get a count of how many state occupational licensing boards there were. The Program Evaluation Division, which is the research arm of the General Assembly, did their study and they came up with 55. That same year, the state auditor, being an auditor, did a slightly better study and came up with 57. But the auditor noted in so doing that one of the problems with oversight over occupational licensing boards and their regulations in North Carolina is it's really hard to get a good count. We're at 58 now, thank you to an additional board added in 2015.
Sanders says it's important to look beyond just the number of licensing boards.
I'm more concerned about how many occupations fall under licensing, under state licensure. So there's an official count provided by the Commerce Department in a website called nccareers.net where they list 181 separate occupations. But I noticed last year, and I noticed earlier this year, that occupations that have come under media for one reason or another, I look them up online and they're not listed.
The numbers can get even more confusing.
Another count from official documents is that there are over 700 regulated acts, different acts that fall under scope of practice. But the count of what is a licensed occupation really depends on how broadly an occupational licensing board interprets its scope of practice. And also, I say, depends on the division of labor. Are teeth whiteners a practice? Is it an act, or is it something that someone does for a living at a kiosk in a mall? Is hair braiding a profession, or is it something that someone does as part of licensed cosmetology? I don't know how many things could be interpreted as an occupation that should fall under licensing. If an OLB decides that's under my scope of practice, some entrepreneur could think they could make a living out of that. So trying to find the exact official count would be difficult, but we've got 181. As it turns out, there are 22% of the state's workforce receives licensing.
How does North Carolina compare to other states when it comes to licensing serving as an economic barrier?
North Carolina has, for example, 641 different disqualifications for licensure for people who have conviction records. We have a lot of instances in the code where We want to make sure that people have good moral character, which is not fleshed out very well. That's second in the Southeast. Only Florida is worse. And these numbers are from the National Employment Law Project. Wisconsin Institute for Law and Liberty looked at how much red tape goes into getting licenses in North Carolina. Their study placed us squarely in the middle of the pack as far as the burden of getting the occupational license. It's not comprehensive. It looks at several licenses that are several occupations that are licensed across the 50 United States. But I think it gives a pretty good indication of where we are. We're not great. We're not terrible. We're right in the middle of the pack. As far as lower income occupations, the Institute for Justice has a really good study, Right to Work, that put us at 17th among states in how many restrictions that we have on lower income occupations.
Speaking of the Institute for Justice, the Institute's senior research analyst, Jenny McDonald, discussed the group's report during the panel discussion.
We look at 102 lower income occupations, and we rank all of the states in terms of how many of these occupations they license, as well as how onerously they license them. And so when you combine both of those, I think it's no surprise to anybody that California is the worst. It gets number one in our ranking. South Carolina is number 22, so not terrible, but it could do a lot better. When you want to get a license in South Carolina, you're going to spend around $220 to get the average license. You're going to have to take two exams, and you're going to spend considerably more than a year in education and training in order to get that license. But South Carolina also has some occupations that are particularly bad when it comes to the licensing burdens. So painting contractors and commercial floor sanders are only licensed by fewer than half the states across the country. If not everybody licenses it, what is the health and safety argument for the requirement of that license in South Carolina? But not only that, South Carolina requires 50% more education and experience to obtain that license than the others who require the license. So not only does not everybody think it's necessary at all, but South Carolina requires 2 years when everybody else requires considerably less time than that. So those are just a couple of examples that highlight the irrationality of occupational licensing in South Carolina specifically.
McDonald pointed to evidence that suggests some licenses require too much time for education and training.
I think our favorite example is when we look at emergency medical technicians who are not paramedics, but they're the first people on the scene when there's a car accident or some other disaster. And they can get licensed in South Carolina in just 34 days. And that short amount of licensing time is pretty consistent across the country. So then explain to me why it takes three times as long to become a licensed makeup artist or 10 times as long to become a licensed carpenter in South Carolina. Now, again, that health and safety argument that the licensing boards like to make falls short here.
McDonald noted the impact of licensing on consumers in South Carolina and across the country.
Being a room of economists, we all know about cartels and monopolies and how the economics behind that allow for individuals to increase their own wages, charge higher prices, and provide lower quality service with that lack of competition. And that's what we see with licensing boards across the board, if you will. I think a particularly interesting example is African-style hair braiding. So there are some states that are better than others in that they don't require a full-on cosmetology license in order to braid hair. But these specialty licenses that they have take a range of hours to complete. Now, South Carolina is particularly good because it only requires 6 hours of sanitation training in order to get that braider license, compared to over 400 hours in Oklahoma. And so when we studied the effects of these, we were looking originally at the health and safety effect, and we found no health and safety effect when it came to lower licensing regulations. But what we did find was a significant effect on the concentration of braiders. So South Carolina has 12 more braiders per 10,000 black residents than other states with stricter licensing requirements for braiders. And so that just shows the very real impact of low-income individuals that are being kept out of a job because of these licensing requirements.
That's Jenny McDonald of the Institute for Justice speaking recently during a panel addressing the downside of occupational licensing in North Carolina and South Carolina. It was part of the annual meeting of the group Classical Liberals in the Carolinas. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Who knew you could shop and invest in freedom at the same time? It is true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate the John Locke Foundation to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop. Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. Here's how. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile is the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible Amazon Smile purchases to the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate us as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. U.S. Senator Tom Tillis wants to see quicker action on hurricane relief. He explained why during a recent news conference in Raleigh. Tillis started by focusing on Hurricane Matthew.
Within hours before landfall, I had my staff, two of them are here in the room, working on what we could do to make sure that the funds would be available as quickly as possible. We were able to secure about $236 million in funding within a matter of weeks after the storm. That $236 million in funding, only 7% of it has been spent over the last 500 days. Now, if you're a storm victim, if you're someone who was hit by Matthew, were promised a buyout, didn't get the buyout, rebuilt your home, and had it destroyed in Florence, they've got to be asking the question, why isn't that money flowing sooner? That's the question we're asking. There may be a legitimate answer for a portion of it, but it's hard to believe that it would be for all of it. We're out there every day in Washington trying to fight for additional funding. We know we need funding for recovery. We need funding for resiliency. But I will tell you, ladies and gentlemen, it hurts our case when we're designated as a slow spender. It hurts our case when other states that absorb very similar damage seem to be doing much, much better. We're filing a bill to address some of the concerns that we've heard by going out into the communities, talking to the county and city governments, Democrats and Republicans alike, to figure out how we can solve this problem and get the resources to the people who need it, the businesses, the counties, the towns, and most importantly, the families, many of whom have been out of their home for hundreds of days. Our bill and the proposed legislation that we'll be putting forward is fairly straightforward. For communities that we feel like, for communities who choose to, we want to stand up a capability within HUD to give them a direct link to federal agencies to get the money to them as quickly as possible. Sadly, so many of these communities are pretty good at responding to disasters because they've had to experience them so much more. So we're calling on the governor to give us answers to questions about why the money hasn't been spent. We'll look at them objectively and determine whether or not it was the linkage with the federal government that needs to be fixed. We're also holding the federal government accountable. In the same way we did with the initial response, when we saw actions by FEMA that we thought didn't make sense, we worked with FEMA to say, are you constrained by the law or you've got a process or a procedure that needs to change? In many cases, they just change minor things.
That's U.S. Senator Tom Tillis, Republican from North Carolina. He's outlining concerns about the state's response to federal hurricane disaster relief. Tillis wants to see a quicker response. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Are North Carolina lawmakers hooked on phonics? Based on a recent debate in the state house, the answer is no. Republican State Representative Larry Pittman wanted to amend an education reform bill. He explained how.
In support of this plan, intensive phonics instruction shall be given to each student at least through first grade. Let me tell you why I want to do that. Sometimes we discard the so-called old-fashioned way of doing something just because it's old-fashioned without stopping to think of the fact that it has worked so well for so long. Phonics means how you put words together. I mean, that's what it's about. Not to have phonics like we did when I was a kid is like trying to teach somebody to lay brick when you don't teach them the relationship between brick and mortar.
Pittman offered personal examples supporting phonics instruction.
When our son Samuel was in third grade, everybody's concerned all over the state about third graders not being able to read. Our son couldn't read in the third grade, and we tried to help him. He'd come to words, you know, and we'd say, sound it out. He had no idea what we meant. That's when we realized he wasn't being taught phonics in school, hadn't been. And so we homeschooled him. My wife started teaching him phonics, and before you knew it, he was reading a whole lot better and eventually got to read very well. So I think that's just one example of the difference. The opposite example is my own experience. My grandmama, bought me a Bible when I was 7 years old in the second grade. And I sat down and immediately started reading 6 chapters a day and understood it. Why? Because we had phonics throughout the first grade, the whole year. We had phonics. So I knew how to read by the time I got to second grade. Phonics is something that does not need to be left behind, relegated to the dustbin of history, It's something we need to bring back.
Pittman also wants teachers to learn how to teach phonics.
This instruction shall include a 3-credit-hour course solely dedicated to the teaching of phonics and the American English system to prepare teachers to know how and be able to teach phonics as it needs to be done so our kids can learn to read.
Pittman won some support from Democratic colleagues, including Marianne Black of Durham.
I would prefer that it would go beyond first grade, and I understand what Representative Pittman is saying. I don't know what the dollar amount would be to teach this. Let's hope that it does not increase what it would cost to teach children phonics. But if they don't understand phonics, then it becomes very hard to read.
Democrat Charles Graham of Robeson County also spoke in favor of Pittman's plan.
When we're talking about teaching to read, we know all children do not learn the same way. Phonics is a different way to work with some students who may not be able to understand whole language reading. And, you know, we've done this in the past. We've had our children be exposed to different levels or different types of reading instruction. And knowing that phonics works with some students, it's not something that all students need to be exposed to. But there are students in our system who cannot read, they cannot decode words, they cannot comprehend because they're trying to understand the written language. And phonics is a good method, it's a proven method.
But Larry Pittman's proposal for mandatory phonics instruction through first grade hit a roadblock. Republican Craig Horn of Union County wants to give more flexibility to the Department of Public Instruction.
We're asking DPI to convene people, experts in these fields, to come back with a plan. Now, I like phonics. I grew up with phonics, but one could question how effective that was based on my ability to express myself. Nevertheless, at this point, I'm going to suggest to you that as much as I like the idea, I'm not at all certain that it needs to be, as it says in this amendment, shall, not may, that needs to be thrust into the process at this point. I'm interested in listening to the experts, as we should all be, and let the data drive our decision rather than make a decision and then go look for data to support it.
Democrat Ashton Clemens of Guilford County also raised objections.
When we teach children to read, which I've spent most of my life doing, there are 5 areas that are considered part of reading instruction. Phonics is one of them, phonemic awareness, comprehension, vocabulary, and fluency. None of any of those 5 is more important than another 5 to help a child ultimately be successful in reading. There are some children who are strong at fluency, which means reading like you talk, but are not strong at phonics. That child does need intensive phonics instruction. There are other children for whom phonics is a strength, but they cannot read fluently, and that child needs to read and practice fluency. As such, prescribing an overemphasis on one of those 5 ultimately would negatively affect, in my opinion, the reading of all of our children. The intention of the individual reading plans, as written in this bill, is for children to have the instruction on whichever of those 5 areas they need, and prescribing all of them to have phonics does not help overall the reading of our state.
Republican Hugh Blackwell questioned the idea of mandating phonics instruction for all kindergartners and first graders.
The point of this bill is to try to address the particular issues of individual students by assessing what they individually need. And what each one individually needs may well be different, as Representative Clemens just said, from others. To have a blanket requirement that everybody's got to spend a year on phonics, even if they get it in the first 3 months or the first half of the year, is counterproductive. Those children could be working on other needs that they have. As Representative Graham said, though I think he reached the wrong conclusion on the amendment, each child is different. And for that reason, we don't need a blanket requirement. We need to understand that the bill allows for DPI to look into these things, and it provides for individual reading, which is the direction that we need to go, not one size fits all.
Republican Michael Speciale of Craven County endorsed the phonics mandate.
When I went through school, by the time we went through eighth grade, most of us knew how to read and write. Unlike today, some of them are graduating college and still do not have not been able to grasp proper grammar and good decent reading and writing. I've read some stuff that is embarrassing. But phonics was taught then, and it was taught to all the kids. And that's what helped all the kids be able to read and write. Most of the kids that I left, because at that time, at the time that I went through, a time that many of you in this room went through, for some kids, eighth grade was as far as you were going to go, or 10th grade was as far as you were going to go. And so what you got out of high school or what you got out of grade school was all you were going to get. It was effective. Most of the people in my age group can read and write. Most of the people in our age group can read and write. And it's the younger folks that are having a problem. It's the younger folks whose literacy is in question. And it's because of changes made in the school systems.
Larry Pittman summed up his support for mandatory phonics instruction through first grade.
This is the basics. This is fundamental to reading. And, you know, just because it's the old way doesn't mean that it's not good, that it wasn't right, that it didn't work.
The House voted down Pittman's plan, but a unanimous House supported additional study of the value of phonics instruction. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Real influence. You either have it or you don't. And at the John Locke Foundation, we have it. You'll find our guiding principles in many of the Freedom Forward reforms of the past decade here in North Carolina. So while others talk or complain or name call, we provide research, solutions, and hope. Our team analyzes the pressing issues of the day, jobs, health care, education, and more. We look for effective ways to give you more freedom, more options, more control over your life. Our goal is to transform North Carolina into a growing, thriving economic powerhouse, the envy of every other state. Our research has helped policymakers make decisions that ensure you keep more of what you earn, expand your choice of schools for your kids, widen your job opportunities, improve your access to doctors. The recipe for stability and a bright future. For truth, for freedom, for the future of North Carolina. We are the John Locke Foundation. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. North Carolina has now notched a victory for healthcare access and healthcare choice. Association health plans, known as AHPs, will now be an option for self-employed business owners and small businesses in our state. The John Locke Foundation's Jordan Roberts, who is our healthcare policy analyst, is joining us now to tell us about the opportunity and the benefits we are likely to see because of this. Jordan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, let's talk a little bit about the predicament of a small business owner in accessing and providing health insurance for employees. It's not been an easy thing.
Nope, that's right. You know, what we've seen over the last couple of years, especially after the Affordable Care Act was put into place, that individuals buying insurance by themselves and small businesses are really having trouble affording the plans that are on the Affordable Care Act exchanges. And, you know, that really leaves these businesses and individuals with a limited number of options and, you know, maybe even going without insurance because of that unaffordability problem. And so what Association Health Plans do is they give a new opportunity to small businesses with generally less than about 50 people or individuals who buy insurance on their own to group together, band together, and buy insurance as a large group and, you know, get some more affordable plans that way.
Sounds commonsensical to me. Okay, so why did we have to pass a law to allow these to even occur?
Right. So when the Affordable Care Act was signed into place, the Obama administration really curtailed the use of association health plans. They made them very difficult to come together and make one. And so now with these new rules from the Trump administration, they reopened them back up and, created more flexibility and more opportunity for groups to get together and buy insurance through a large group through an association.
Give us an example of how this might work. Are we talking about an industry trying to group together or by region or location?
Sure. So the rule, as written by the Trump administration. Now, I must say it's going through some legal troubles in the court right now. There's been some states that have sued over it, but hopefully that'll get figured out soon and we'll be, you know, allowed to sell all of these different types of plans. But, you know, what the plans really do is they allow groups of similar trade industry or similar region to group together and buy a plan as a large group in that area. So, for example, one of the big supporters here in North Carolina was the Realtors Association. Now, most realtors are working on their own or just a small group, so their insurance options were limited. But now, with an association health plan, the North Carolina Realtors Association can purchase a plan and allow their member employers, the group, the individuals that belong to the group, to, you know, buy a plan together with other realtors and get a large group plan that way.
This sounds like great news for
it
people
is.
To
it
have
is.
An option. And for some people, you mentioned those folks and realtors, and I can think of other groups as well, mm-hmm. where they have really been stuck.
That's
trying
right.
to buy on their own, just as a one person going out into the private market, particularly mm-hmm. if someone makes too much money to qualify for some sort of a subsidy through
right.
Obamacare, they've been stuck. But this seems to really be opening things up so that they could choose what works for them. It also has its critics, of course.
Sure.
AHPs do. Now,
yeah.
the big thing that critics seem to have been saying about AHPs is that they would not cover pre-existing conditions. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so this really comes down to the way you word this. So, you know, one of the big things that the Affordable Care Act did was that it mandated all these individual and small group plans had to cover list of 10 essential health benefits, couldn't deny people for pre-existing conditions, and can't really charge more than a 3-to-1 ratio of premiums based on health status. And so what this does now is it allows these groups to come together and buy insurance, and the rules that are placed on these insurance plans are the same as the large group market. So what you're going to see is, while the mandate isn't there for all different types of coverage, no one can be denied for pre-existing conditions. So while the plans don't have as many mandates as the Affordable Care Act plans, what we're seeing, though, is these plans are still covering, you know, a robust set of benefits, and so people are really getting the coverage they need.
You know, you and I are both believers in the free market and consumer demand really helping businesses, including insurance companies, mm-hmm. to move towards what their potential customers want.
That's right.
So is it reasonable to think of a scenario where, let's say, a group comes together, they form an association health plan, and then they find that there is something in particular that a lot of their members are saying they would like to have as
right.
part of a health insurance plan, and for them to then use their power to go to insurance companies and say, yeah, this is what we're looking for.
Yeah.
Can you offer this to us? And if so, what's the price?
That's right. And, you know, like you said, this is a more market-driven plan where the members and the associations are choosing what benefits that their members need, rather than a government mandated slate of benefits that drives up costs when you're not really using that, because a group of all male farmers doesn't need mandated maternity coverage. So, you know, it's things like this that, you know, we can really get down to what these folks need. They're in similar trade and industry groups, similar regions, they have similar health needs. So, you know, it's really more tailored to the individual, and it gives these folks a lot more options to buy insurance on the market.
For the longest time, Jordan, I think you and I have probably talked about it on this program as mm-hmm. well. When we thought about reforming health insurance and trying to expand access to care, we kind of came down to a question of, well, we have the Affordable Care Act. That's mm-hmm. the law of the land right now. So that needs to be repealed to let
sure.
the marketplace work.
Yeah.
But what my observation is that what is happening is that the Affordable Care Act is still in place,
mm-hmm.
yet somehow or another, and perhaps it's through executive orders from the mm-hmm. Trump administration, allowing states more options, with AHPs being one. Is that fair to characterize it that way?
Absolutely. And yeah, we're seeing a lot of states that are, you know, applying for these waivers to really take control of their insurance markets and allow these different options outside of the Affordable Care Act to be sold. And, you know, the winners there are really the patients, and especially those individuals or small groups that really didn't have any other option except the Affordable Care Act. But the Trump administration has really done a wonderful job of increasing different choices and just allowing patients to make the best decision on what type of health coverage they need, what they can afford, and, you know, allowing the market to flourish and offer these options.
Jordan, you have also written about another pathway towards more access and more affordable care. And you've written that there are actually state laws and regulations in place right now that lawmakers in our state could change those laws to put pressure, downward pressure, on prices. Tell us about some of the options where we could, without having to go to the federal government, make some changes, positive changes here.
Yeah. So, you know, on the at the delivery level, you know, there's a lot of changes we can make, specifically certificate of need laws, repealing those to allow, you know, private actors rather than the government to decide where healthcare facilities can be. There's restrictions on nurse practitioners and advanced practice nurses in the state, where if we were to remove those restrictions, we could really, you know, open up the access in rural areas, hopefully, you know, with more nurses practicing out there. You know, there's plenty of insurance mandates that, like we said, those mandates on insurance add costs for patients. They're passed right on to patients. So there's a lot of, you know, supply side reforms that we can do to drive down price, along with giving people other options of insurance coverage. And, you know, that's what we think a good, healthy, robust market would look like.
Jordan Roberts is the healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation. He has written extensively about all of these healthcare issues, and you can find all of that analysis at johnlocke.org, also carolinajournal.com. Jordan, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Appreciate you listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for another edition of Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.